This is Friday, April 11, 2014. We are in the studios of Fitchburg Access Television, and this interview is part of the continuing Veterans Oral History Project based at the Morse Institute Library in Natick, Massachusetts. My name is Maureen Sullivan. Our cameraman is A.J. Perkonis of Fitchburg Access Television. We are privileged to have with us today Vincent Bill Purple. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
May I ask when you were born?
I was born on May 7th, 1924.
And where were you born?
I was born in the community of Athol, Massachusetts.
And where do you currently live?
I currently live in Petersham, Massachusetts, which abuts Athol. Mm-hmm.
And what is your marital status?
Widower.
And do you have children?
I have two children. I have a daughter, Cynthia, and I have a son, Philip.
But currently no grandchildren?
No grandchildren.
All right. Tell us what Athol was like when you were growing up.
It's very difficult, I think, to say how Athol was at that point. However, you're going back in history of 60, 70 years, and all of today's things that are taken for granted or seen electronically and whatnot, did not exist. Mm-hmm. Transportation primarily was with horses or limited automobiles. You had a milkman that delivered milk by a horse and a buggy to your home. You had glass bottles. You have to go back. Everything was marvelous at that point in time. And I'm going back into a memory here of about 1930, mm-hmm. 35, in that range. It was just a marvelous place to live, in my honest opinion. And again, be it the generation of youngsters to whatever age which mine was then, it was you could go do and whatever you wanted to and have fun, leave in the morning, come back at night, make sure you get home in time for mom to feed you the apple pie, and you're all set.
And let's get into your family background a little bit. Tell us a bit about your mother and father.
Well, in regard to that, both my parents were immigrants from Poland. And my mother, I think, came in 1906, and my dad, I think, was either 1904 or 5. They settled in Athol. Why they picked Athol, to this day, I have no visibility. However, they took and became citizens of the United States, mm-hmm. did their thing, and both were very pleased to be here. My dad worked for the Ellis Sterrett Company from day one until he retired. And my mother, she just was here, and when they both were married, and she took care of the 6 children mm-hmm. that were part of their family.
Now, hopefully you went to school during this period.
I think I did.
Did you go to Athol High School?
I went to Athol High School, graduated in 1941 at age 17, and mm-hmm. went from there, and then that's about the time, 17, you run the arithmetic together. We're chasing down the path to what happened at Pearl Harbor in December of 1941.
So where were you on December 7th?
Very easy question. Fortunately for me and for the youngsters that call them youngsters or my buddies, his dad owned the Oldsmobile Pontiac Garage sales agency in Athol, and we were able to borrow a car that day, the demonstrator. And we were riding by at an area just about a half a mile from where I lived. Mm-hmm. And we heard on the radio on that particular Sunday, about 4 o'clock, that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
Were you aware where Pearl Harbor was located?
No. Had no visibility. Mm-hmm. It was, at that point in time, to me anyway, whatever the political ratios and structure was with this country and Japan was an unknown. You didn't have TV, mm-hmm. maybe you had a radio.
Right.
I stayed in a hotel one time where the hotel bragged that they had a radio in every room, so that's where you're looking at.
Right. When you were attending Athol High School, were you made aware of events that were happening in Europe and Asia?
Not really.
Not really. Hmm. So tell us what happened after Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think you can put it this way. After Pearl Harbor, that was December again. Mm-hmm. So come About April of 1942, there was a situation developed, and I was partially employed as a youngster at the Union Twist Drill Company and was a mail boy or something, whatever, forgotten by now. And there was a fellow by the name of Omar Cowett who had applied for the Aviation Cadet Program of the aviation at that point in time. And he went through a testing process and didn't quite make the grade. So someplace one day on a Sunday, I decided to go to the Orange Airport and take a ride in an airplane. And I did exactly that. And the beauty of it all was the ride wasn't a Piper Cub. The ride was fun. I didn't get sick and throw up or anything, so I decided at that point I would join the Air Force. And so subsequent to that Sunday, I ended up making the necessary applications, and then Omar Cowett, I can't think of the word, but anyway, he taught me everything I needed to know about the processes of possibly being selected as an aviation cadet. So that when the time came, the day came, that I had to take the particular exams and whatnot, I was successful in participating for the quality and grades levels that they were talking about. So that was about July of 1942.
And where did you take the test?
I think I took it in Worcester, but it, again, you ask a question, I'm not sure.
All right.
But that's okay. And so I took the test, and subsequent to that, we'll say it was just July, subsequent to that, that's when the troops were signing up or going to be drafted and all the various things along that line. So having qualified for the Aviation Cadet Program, I would not be drafted, I would be called to active duty when the programs were geared. And at this point in time, because what was happening in Europe, amongst other things, there were 50,000 people being trained as aviation cadets. And so it, I guess it was about November of 42, received notification to report to Springfield, Mass., the post office, and you were called to active duty. And that was what actually did happen in January of 1943. I went to Springfield with three other people from Athol, three particular individuals, Dick Dunham, Wiz White, and Doug Starrett, and we went down to my dad's car. And Dad said hi and bye, and then that we were in the military at that day. Walked in the post office, and that was it.
Okay.
So now we'll put it back within a day, January, I'm sure it was either the 28th or the 29th. We then got on a train, and were transported from Springfield to Atlantic City, which was going to be our basic training. Awful long ride between Springfield and Atlantic City because I don't know why they decided to go to Ohio before going to Atlantic City, but that's where they went. It's Cincinnati. We went from Springfield to Buffalo and so forth to Cincinnati and then to Springfield, rather to Atlantic City, 24 hours later. And therefore, stepped off the train about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm now in the military.
That's one weird detour.
I have to this day can't comprehend why that was done. So just an offshoot story to that, when we arrived and whatnot, they decided to feed us. We hadn't been fed from the time we left. And long story short, again, use that expression, they fed us chili. I had never eaten chili, but it wasn't bad. But that was it. That's how we started my military, let's say, on active duty.
Well, was this your first time away from home?
Other than when I went skiing, because we would go on skiing up into Woodstock, Vermont, Pico Peak in Rutland. We went to Canada. We had fun skiing. We were allowed at age 15 and 16 to go do that.
Okay.
But my answer to that then may be yes, huh? So from that viewpoint, okay.
Okay, well, tell us a little more about basic.
Well, basic training is, if you've been to Atlantic City, fine. We went there, and on the boardwalk that was there, and there were countless hotels. and we were put up in hotels for the 30 days that we were there. And from that viewpoint, training was out on the beach. And we spent the 30 days in marching, learning whatever the military discipline was. Went out to Brigantine Field one time that was 20 miles away to go to the rifle range. I shot a gun once in the military at that point. But we knew how to shoot guns because we played with those particular things in Athol. And again, depending on where you were, and there were thousands and thousands of us in Atlantic City. And so let's say that if you're watching, marching on the beach and you're out in front, wasn't too bad because the sand was still hard, but you put thousands of people over and you're in sand up to your knees. Anyway, part of what you learn. So at the conclusion of 30 days, three of us that went, the four of us, by the way, were in Atlantic City, as I said, when we entered in Springfield. We ended up being assigned to Rochester, the Rochester Business Institute, for an eight-week session at the College Training Detachment, which is start of the phase of eight, I think it was about 16 months of training that we were going to have before we graduated as pilots out of the military. So we went to Rochester, and again, school, we were taught how to fly an airplane, and we had 10 hours of time, that was it. I think one of the impressionable things that still is in my mind today is at the airport in Rochester, a DC-3, which is at that point in time was the airplane of the American Airlines, had never seen one, and it pulled in with its customers and whatnot, and as it was a twin engine, a twin engine operation, and when it pulled up to park, the pilot took and pulled the window back, pulled a flag out and stuck it out there and said, American Airlines. And that's your introduction to the military and the industrial business of air flight.
Okay, before so we continue, I just wanted to clarify, Rochester as in Rochester, New York?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And we paraded down, up and down the streets. That was our training. Other than the sand of Atlantic City, we used the highway in downtown, and of course everybody was happy to see us at that point. So after the eight-week period, we had what you call, that was step one after basic training. And your next assignment was from there, providing everything was going the way it was supposed to. By the way, that was the year that Frankie Sinatra put Black Magic on the song, whatever. Things, well, you remember strange things. You're pulling them out today, by the way.
Keep it going.
Whatever. So anyway, we were assigned to Nashville, Tennessee. And object of going to Nashville, again, was either another about 6 to 8 weeks. And again, this pilot training program or cadet aviation cadet program, they wanted to make sure everybody there was going to be able to qualify to the next step, to the next one, and so forth. So you had all kinds of training, being military, be it bombing schemes and anything that they could think of to say, okay, yes, you know what you're doing. You can at least see as well. That helps, you know.
Right. Now, during the training, you mentioned earlier that you had some hours in an actual airplane.
That was in Rochester.
Okay, and what kind of planes were you flying?
That was a Piper Cub.
The Pipers, okay.
Piper Cub, yes. We had 10 hours of flight training.
Okay.
We did not solo. We just had 10 hours of ride, and they said, okay, if you do this, that, or the other thing, that's what airplanes are about.
Okay.
So back to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
We were there, I think, about 6 weeks. And again, I was blessed at being able to take and perform to their specs and their specifications. And so I was then assigned to the next step of aviation cadet program. And now you're really getting into the top dog of the operation. And we were assigned to go to Maxwell Field, Alabama, which we went there for 2 months. And you were the underclassman when you got there for a month, and then you were the upperclassman for the second month, and that was a rotation type of thing. And again, you're being weeded out, structured, as to everything that they were teaching you. And if you didn't qualify, then that was the end of that portion. You would end up probably going into the infantry or whatever mm-hmm. they might have, needing people for that point. So anyway, back to being lucky, qualified, whatever. I did meet all their criteria and was assigned to Primary Flight School in Lafayette, Louisiana.
You keep going south, south, south.
Well, okay, I should say I was in the Southeast Training Command, mm-hmm. which is, we call it Chicago to New Orleans to the East Coast.
Okay.
That was more mostly covered there. So Lafayette, Louisiana, and now we're back to, again, another two-month schedule. And at this time and case, we ended up being there, and now we're going to learn to fly. Mm-hmm. You might learn other things, but flight was the object. So we went out with what they call the Fairchild PT-23, which is a twin-seat operation, one in front, one in back, and instructor pilots went out flying, and they showed us what flying was about again, mm-hmm. this time really serious. And then after qualified landings and takeoffs and all the things that are involved, spirals, loops, and forced landings, it was a lot of fun.
Mm.
A lot of fun. After 5 hours, we landed at the instructor pilot told me to land at a little field that I saw over on the right, grass field. And he got out and he says, okay, go fly. 5 hours of training, and so I looked at him, he looked at me, he says, you're qualified. So got at the end of the runway and did what you're supposed to, put uh-huh. the power to the engine and took off, and you're supposed to make a left-hand turn, a right-hand turn, a left-hand turn, come back and land. And I did that, and he said, that was pretty good. So long story short, I am now able to fly an airplane by myself after 5 hours of time. And it was okay. Mm-hmm. We did many things with airplanes. And so we put in, I think I saw something in my logbook recently that we had 60 hours of training in primary flight school.
Mm-hmm.
So now from there, after that happened, now we're getting into October, I guess, of 43.
Mm-hmm.
We get transferred to basic flight school. Now that's in Walnut Ridge, Arkansas. Now here you're going into much heavier, much larger, powerful aircraft, and again, same type of thing. You're able to fly now. You're real good. You think you're wonderful, mm-hmm. you know. You can do that. So anyway, a few hours of dual training, and then you were told to do this, that, or the other. And again, we got 60 hours of training in Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, in basic flight school. Strange thing. Got lost there one time flying, and had gone out and on my mission as I was instructed to do, and spent half an hour or three quarters of an hour in doing aerobatics and whatnot, which again, that's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But then here where I am over Arkansas someplace, and I don't know where the base is.
Oh no.
No yeah. radios, mm-hmm. you ain't gonna find out. So you know how you find out? You find a railroad track and you fly up the railroad track and read the sign on the station, and then you try to find it on the map. And that worked out successfully because I'm here, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah, so anyway, just nice little things like that happened in my mm-hmm. life, and I have to say this another way. I've had marvelous things happen in my life with the military, amongst other things. So, okay, we graduate from basic flight school and go to advanced flight school. Now, we're going to be in advanced flight school at Stuttgart, Arkansas. And that's just further, a little further north than Walnut Ridge. And now we're in twin-engine aircraft. And now we're starting to take and be indoctrinated and trained on flying aircraft because they're leading us into being pilots, and we're going to end up flying four-engine aircraft mm-hmm. for combat in Europe. So we took and we would have two of us, both of us being trainees. We'd fly formation with one or the other alternately as you needed to mm-hmm. and whatnot. And in March of 1944, I was 19 at that point, I graduated from flight school and was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army Air Corps. And so here I am now, mm-hmm. from November rather of 1942 to March of 44. I've graduated from young mm-hmm. squirt to whatever it is.
Right.
And now I am a pilot. Now mm-hmm. I'm an officer of the United States Army. And so I was allowed a 30-day leave, which I did come home to Athol and visit the parents and all that sort of stuff. And I assume you want me to keep going.
Well, just let's get you back to Arkansas for a minute. I mean, you had all this training down in the Deep South. Were you ever able to get off base and kind of check out the communities?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And did you notice segregation?
No.
Really?
There was no reason. That was not in my brain at that time.
Uh-huh.
Found some nice young ladies.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, indeed.
No, the people were very nice to us all and all and whatnot. Mm-hmm. No, we would be flying Saturdays and Sundays, but mm-hmm. there was days off.
Right. And also the other three guys from Athol who accompanied you, did they finish?
Well, two of them went with me to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, he went someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
They both ended up graduating from flight school. Mm-hmm. We lost each other in Rochester.
Uh-huh.
But they both ended up being in the military, being pilots mm-hmm. that were in that group. And Dick Dunham, there's a great story there.
Mm.
Dick Dunham was a pilot, graduated from flight school someplace else, not in the Southeast. So all three of us, well, and add me, I guess, all four of us were very successful in our assigned destiny there.
Mm. All right, so you're on 30-day leave in Athol. Tell us what happened next.
Well, we spent the 30 days here and whatnot, and then had orders cut that I had even before I left that I was to go to Sebring, Florida, on whatever specific date it was then,
mm-hmm.
to report for four-engine bomber training, bomber aircraft training. So arrived at Sebring, Florida, and again, you have to look into the whole phase of it. They're teaching you everything that you need to know. What's an engine? How is it? What's wrong? If the door doesn't open, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to the nth degree. But when I got to Sebring and went out to the aircraft,
mm-hmm.
I think that I will say this, and I have never been more impressed in my life, because here we're playing with little baby airplanes, and the B-17, you stood there and you looked up like that and you said, wow. And you walk around and
mm-hmm.
you're talking an aircraft now, a twin engine or a single engine aircraft might weigh 5,000 pounds, depending which one it is. The B-17 weighs 60,000 pounds. It's got four engines on it and whatnot.
Right.
So long story again, we were trained.
Mm-hmm.
There would be two or three of us that would fly with the instructor, and I'm flying for 10 minutes or 20 minutes, and you are in the next one, and constantly, until finally you were trained, and then you would go out with just your other friends.
Mm-hmm.
Being we're all friends because we're all heading in the same direction.
Right.
And none of us are going to do anything that's going to be wrong to each other. That's not the issue. And, of course, you were trained on how to take a four-engine aircraft off. And if you lost two engines, you still keep going. If you lost three engines, that wasn't too good, but you had to experiment. Mm-hmm. And many things like that happened during the training session. Specifically, I got taught a lesson real fast on one particular training session, because the instructor pilot advised me. He says, Lieutenant, he says, if you lose the hydraulic system, how do you get the wheels down? And he says, you crank them down. He says, go take, open the bomb bay doors, go take and put the crank in there and crank the wheels down. So visualize your whatever thousands of feet in the sky, didn't make any difference. And you're leaning out there and you are cranking the wheels down. And that's not an easy job, because you're going 150 miles an hour, the big wheels coming at the headwind and so forth. So anyway, I got the wheels down and reported back. And I said, wheels down, sir. And he says, fine. He says, and he put the wheels back up and whatnot. And then he called me back. He says, if you if we lose the hydraulic system, he says, how do we get the wheels down? I said, you crank them down. Go crank them down again. I'm good at that.
Okay.
But anyway, I kept doing that twice.
Twice.
I came back and reported, and he says, why don't you learn something? And I says, what's your problem? I don't think I said that because you're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. In any event, he says, well, you know, for me, and I lost the hydraulic system, he says, there's no problem getting the wheels down or up. I says, what? He says, they're electric, just hit the switch. Okay, end of subject.
Uh-huh.
I always remember that, but I just hit the switch.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that's the type of thing that happened for fun. So anyway, we did that, and then that happened in 1944,
mm-hmm.
and that would have been April. Then I was a graduate four-engine pilot. So now I'm qualified to fly single-engine aircraft, two-engine aircraft, and four-engine aircraft.
Okay.
Ended up saying, okay, now the next step is you are going to take and go to Plant City in Florida.
Plant City?
Plant, P-L-A-N-T.
Okay.
I think that's what it was. And we went there. No, change it. It was Tent City.
Tent City.
Tent City.
There you go.
Yeah, it was Tent City. And we will assign you a combat crew. Mm-hmm. So that was outside of Tampa. And so went up there and whatever time it took them, now in days or a week or something, and then suddenly I was assigned nine other people to be in my bomb group crew. I had a navigator, a bombardier, co-pilot, top turret gunner, two waist gunners, ball turret gunner, and tail gunner. They come to 10, including me.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they were assigned. So that was it. Next move was to take and be transferred to what they call occupational flight transition. You now are going to learn how to fly combat missions and likewise be ready to be sent overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So they shipped us off to Gulfport, Mississippi, Biloxi area, and we went through again another 10-week period. Everything is in 10-week increments. I guess from that part, we did all that was necessary there. We actually flew formation with 10 or 12 aircraft because that was the posture of what was happening in Europe at that point in time. And we shot at each other with wood bullets. We had the aircraft that General Chenault had of that type, the P-40, that they would attack us and shoot at us with wood bullets, we'd shoot wood bullets back. Not sure that was a good plan, but whatever, if that was the rule that day.
Mm-hmm.
Almost got court-martialed for flying up New Orleans at about 100 feet. You're not supposed to fly low, you know, with four-engine bombers. But that's okay. That's why you do these things. And so while we were at Gulfport, and to this day, by the way, my crew still exists. Of my navigator's still around.
Mm-hmm.
And my waist gunner is still around, Howard Seitzer, and the navigator is Alex DeSanto. I see him every year.
Mm-hmm.
But Howard and I have talked many a time, and we say, why did this next event happen? And we have no idea, but someplace I got called into operations and said, Lieutenant, you are going to take your crew and you're going to meet with 9 or 10 other airplanes, whatever, excuse me, in the area of in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to go to Havana, Cuba. So, fine. Well, come to find out, we were invited by the International Rotary Club to come down there on a goodwill tour. The 12 of us, 12 aircraft. And we spent, excuse me, darn.
Oh, the water's right there if you need.
That would be a good plan.
Okay. Okay,
so we all end it, huh?
You're at Havana Rotary Club Goodwill Tour. Take it.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. So we landed. Oh, darn. So anyway, we landed in Havana. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was probably the nicest visit anybody can ever have, because that was when Batista was still around. Havana was as good a place as you could go to visit. We had dinners. We stayed at the best hotel possible in Havana, the Hotel Nacional de Cuba. Mm-hmm. And we had dinner dances, and we had went swimming, went to Valladero Beach. I have newspaper clippings of all that. Mm-hmm. And but dinner dance was wonderful. Everybody had a date. Mm-hmm. I had a pair of twins. I haven't figured that out yet. Rosie and Faith are beautiful ladies. Mm-hmm. And we communicated after we left there, and Rosie was a real friend, high class operation and whatnot. And she wrote to me all the time I was overseas, mm-hmm. type of thing. Well, anyway, we ended up in Havana. From Havana, we ended up, that was just a 5-day trip, and we went back to Gulfport. And from Gulfport, that was in early September. The trip to Havana was on September 14th. I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
And we took and ended up being said, now it's time to go to combat. So someplace after the trip to Havana, they took and assigned that whole group of aircraft people to go to Savannah, Georgia, and get a brand new B-17. And end up start to fly it over to England. Mm-hmm. I mean, here again, I'm only a 19, 20-year-old kid, you know.
Right.
Everybody I've got on my crew is older than me by far. But I'm having a good time at it. Uh-huh. So we ended up leaving Savannah to take and fly north. And to continue there, we ended up getting over to about Fort Dix. We were scheduled to land at Grenier Field up in New Hampshire. So as we're approaching between Fort Dix and we get to Springfield, I said to my crew, I says, you know, why don't we go see my parents?
Okay.
This is right, Springfield, Athol, Grenier Field. So we all agreed. So we came over to Athol and made 3 low-level passes. I waved to my mother and father and relatives, and they knew I was there.
Oh, wow.
And here we are. And that's the last time I was going to see them for a long period of time.
Mm.
But we got away with it. Nobody court-martialed us for being flying low. You can do a lot of things if you're going to go to combat. They're going to tell you, say, don't go to combat. Go have fun.
Okay.
So anyway, we flew over Athol and did what we did there, and then we went to Grenier and landed at Grenier because mm-hmm. we had a little engine trouble of some kind. And I think we were only there a day or two while they repaired the engine. Then we went up to Gander, Newfoundland prior to being shipped or flying overseas to Valley, Wales. Now from there, on a real bad night at Gander Field, we took off in a snowstorm.
Ouch.
Real bad. It was mm-hmm. real bad. They should never let us go, but they did. And we took now it was about a 12-hour flight from Gander to Valley, Wales, and managed to land there okay. Nobody was shooting at us over the ocean. The submarines mm-hmm. didn't go that far anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we landed, turned over our aircraft, and then at that point we were assigned to different crews, different people, different airplanes. I was assigned to the 379th Bomb Group in Kimbolton, England. And so to train from Valley, Wales to Kimbolton and arrive there on a particular afternoon, whatever it was, about 4:00, mm-hmm. and the mission was just coming back, and you got the visibility of the flying fortresses returning and all that, and that's how I ended up at the base that I was assigned to fly combat from.
Okay. So this is now around September 1944.
Right.
Normandy has been invaded. The big push is on. How did you keep up with the events happening?
Who cared?
Who cared? Were you listening to the radio, newsreels?
Yeah. Didn't care.
Okay.
The only thing you knew from that visibility of what the events were is you knew when you went to briefing what you were going to do today. And if you want to be told that if you're going to go to Berlin, you're going to go to Stuttgart, you're going to go to Nuremberg, you're going to go wherever, there's where your problems are going to exist with fighters, there's where your problems are going to be with anti-aircraft weapons, this, that, or the other. If you get shot down, you're in trouble over here. But my point, you're making a point there, is I don't remember hardly anything about what the world was doing at that point in time. We would get briefing, and we'll come to that in a little bit, but just to touch there, I mean, I don't remember that, really. It didn't make any difference.
You had other things on your mind. Right.
I think that's hard to define for me.
Right. So you're in England. You're now with the 379th Bomber Group. Are you still a second lieutenant?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so tell us what happened next.
Well, I became a second lieutenant in March. So that's 6 months, 5 months down the road. So I was second lieutenant. At that point, we then ended up being assigned to a squadron within the 379th, of which there were four, and I was assigned to the 525th Squadron, 524, 525, 526, 527, and they each had 12 airplanes. That's what a group would consist of, more than not. And so our first mission went out, and I was flying co-pilot for a trained, experienced pilot and crew. I don't remember. I don't think we even took my crew, just myself. And we went up to the Ruhr Valley and went under combat conditions and the usual thing. There's no way of saying it any different. You're going out that day, today, tomorrow, throughout my whole career, when you were in Europe, you were going to get shot at. I don't care who. The airplanes got you, the anti-aircraft weapons, so whatever. You dodged a bullet and you came home safely, fine. And you landed, and then usually in our base, we had what I consider some very charming young ladies by the name of the Red Cross ladies, and they'd have coffee waiting for you when you get out of the airplane. If you didn't want coffee, you could have bourbon or scotch or whatever.
Okay.
That's a lot better. And then you were free to do what you wanted. Well, now you've been playing the game. Let's say you get back at 4 or 5. You've been playing the game since 2 o'clock in the morning, so you're not going to go very far anyway. No. So anyway, and that was the first mission was successful in the viewpoint that it came back.
Right.
So then the next mission is I've taken my crew, because now I'm supposed to know everything, and you don't know very much anyway. You're going to take and have the lead pilot and the lead crew, and you're going to follow him. And you're going to fly formation very tightly, very close, and when it's time to drop the bombs, you do that. So I flew about 10 missions that way. Very interesting, some of them. But after my 10th mission, I guess they felt that I knew what I was doing. So they assigned me to be a lead pilot. And that's when I lost my crew primarily, because I was then put into the 526 Bomb Squadron. And therefore, when it was time for me to be scheduled for a mission or whatever was going to happen, I would be assigned a crew and we're going to lead the 12 airplanes. And that is how I finished out from November until May of 1945 as a lead pilot, as a squadron leader, as a group leader. And so, how do I want to say this different? We went on missions, and then I think it was in December I was promoted to first lieutenant. And then in May of 45 I was promoted to captain, and I received those orders just prior to coming back from Europe.
Is there any one, how many missions overall did you fly?
35.
35 missions. Is there any mission or missions that stand out?
That what?
that stand out? Do you remember better than
many
most?
Many of them.
Oh, many of them.
This here is the result of crashing four airplanes after being shot up. That's a distinguished flying cross. By the way, there's the same tie.
Really? So if you can hold up that medal and tell us a little bit more, tell us a little bit about how you got that.
Well, all right. Still hold it?
Yeah, you can put it down. Thank you.
Okay, no, I was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross because of four specific missions that I flew over Germany where we ended up doing things out of the ordinary. The aircraft was on fire one time over mm-hmm. Hamburg, and we fell 15,000 feet trying to take and get that fire out. Another time we were shot all to blazes, and again, we were questioning whether we were going to bail out a crew and whatnot. We came back, crashed the airplane, and it's that mm-hmm. type of thing.
Right.
So there were four distinct I had that list at home, but mm-hmm. it was four distinct missions that, if I think back, I'm glad I'm here, mm-hmm. and I'm glad I didn't have to go back.
Right.
There's one there also towards, I was getting ready, maybe the 32nd mission or something like that. Went to Hopstein, Germany, and we were leading the bomb group, the 379th. I had 40-yard airplanes behind me in mm-hmm. formation 12, 12, 12, and 12. And the anti-aircraft weaponry was such that I'm sitting like I'm looking at you here, and I can see on the horizon down the road four shells. Mm-hmm. They burst. And you're flying there. You cannot dodge once you're on a bomb run.
Right.
So therefore, boom, four, boom, four. And you're flying right through it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that's not very good. And the last one, well, prior to getting there, my right wingman got shot down, my left wingman got shot down. We filled them back in. And I'm saying, wow, this is a little frightening. Damn frightening. And the last burst, in my opinion, wasn't any further away than you in front of the plane.
Wow.
But it was above, I'm sitting here as I am here, it was up here.
Uh-huh.
The shell explodes up. And therefore, then it was behind us and then we did the bomb run. But that's exciting.
Needless to say.
And that particular one other mission on this type of thing, we got the My navigator was leaning out the nose of the flying fortress inside,
mm-hmm.
and he says, gee, he called up on the interphone and whatnot, and he says, Herman isn't shooting very good today. And all of a sudden, he gets a shell that comes through and takes the end of his finger off.
Ooh.
I told him to shut up, we don't need him
uh-huh.
anymore. So those are things that can happen. You didn't care.
Uh-huh.
Until you got down towards the end, and I mm-hmm. don't even remember that. I got hit with shrapnel, but I never got injured as such because we wore very heavy mm-hmm. flak suits
right.
with metal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a piece of shell come through on the rudder pedal, take the end of my toe boot off and hit me right here, but I had the suit, so it just bruised it a little bit. No medals, can't get a Purple Heart for that, don't
mm-hmm.
care. But no, so this here is just one of the awards that I have received, and that's a very high distinguished operation.
It is indeed.
And others that I've got, but my career that way, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe it different.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's, you were mentioning briefing earlier in the interview. Can you tell us a little more about what would take place at a briefing?
Okay. Well, first of all, if we're going to go on a mission.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody's going to wake you up at 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, depending on the length of the mission, where you're going for target and whatnot. Okay, so let's just arbitrarily pick off 2 o'clock in the morning. Breakfast served at 3.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets you going, you're going to sit, you get on breakfast at 3. Briefing is at 5. I'm making up these, but that's about right.
Right.
So at briefing now, you're going to take, as pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and bombardier, your four trainees, the other people, the other six, we call them the mechanical people. They've taken care of the airplane and whatnot. Mm-hmm. We're going to see that we take off, we get you there, we get you back. And we're then at a briefing, and you're going to see on a wall, you're going to see a map of England. You're going to see a point there that's going to say Kimbolton, 379th. You're going to see an arrow or a line going to here over to, we'll say, I guess, Berlin. Mm-hmm. So that your people are going to, you're going to be briefed on weather, whatever intelligence they had on enemy resistance, what the weather is over the target, what's going to happen if you can't get back and the weather's bad. You're being told all that. And every B-17 on a raid to Berlin carries 2,900 gallons of gasoline. So my commanding officer led the raid to Berlin on February 3rd, 1945, and there were 1,000 airplanes in that raid. 12. That bomber column was 170 miles long.
Wow.
That's from here to New York. And they're 30 seconds apart.
Mm-hmm. That's precision.
The statistics and everything. But the briefing is that you were just told, and then you were told, okay, you had your airplane, so you were going to be instructed, start engines. By that, they would take and fire a flare and from the terminal building or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you start your engines, and then you already had synchronized on your watch. You then ended up saying, quote, that taxi, get into the runway, and then get in the position to take off when they fire the green flare again at 7 o'clock or whatever it is. Then you all assemble over your base. And now think about this. Here's Kimball, right here where I'm sitting.
Mm-hmm.
We're flying 360-degree circles counterclockwise, and we're putting 48 airplanes 12, 12, 12, and 12. 5 miles over, they're doing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And over there, that's like right here in Fitchburg Airport and Gardner Airport and the one over in Devens.
Mm-hmm.
In that, you got 150 airplanes on the same levels. Very frightening, but mid-air collisions were part of something that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, we all were pretty good. And it wasn't the idea to crash before you dropped your bombs.
Mm.
So in the briefing again, the continuity of that was they tell you everything that you have to know that they have visibility on. I made that presentation with David Bramhall, you don't know him, at Monty Tech on November the 8th. We did it for the whole school of 1,200, and that was the finest thing we ever put together for fun.
Wow.
And it was marvelous.
Uh-huh.
So that's what the briefing's about.
Okay. Now, while you were on a mission, you were mentioning the anti-aircraft. Were your planes ever attacked by enemy aircraft?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
did you ever have a Mustang escort?
If you read there, in there it says I was real happy when they had the Mustangs, the P-51s, because they came along later, the P-47 and the P-38, they were capable of going only a certain amount of miles into what I consider the German territory. The P-51 with the extra tanks were able to take and go further, protect us pretty near all the way.
Okay.
But you always... I'm going to say this. Our group, we flew 330 missions, and we were real good. I'm being a little egotistical, but we were. We're noted, if you read the statistics and whatnot, of having probably as good, the best record of the 8th Air Force.
Right.
So anyway, if you're protecting yourselves by flying the formations as tight as you can, you've got the most guns in position to fire at the opponent fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you got 10 airplanes and you got 13 guns in each one that can focus.
Mm.
If you got one or two aircraft and you got 26 guns, he's going to attack you versus mm-hmm. getting 100 guns or 200 guns aiming at him.
Right.
So they always went to seek out what they consider weaker flight formations, mm-hmm. not necessarily. And that's how that happened.
And as far as targets are concerned, what were your main objectives? Factories, train tracks?
There were three, there were three particular things I believe that developed in the whole war structure. First of all, you got D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy concentration of D-Day was to take and prepare the Omaha Beach area, St. Mary, Greece, and different places like that to accommodate the Americans and the British landing. So they bombed that in time and time and time again, the whole of Sepot area, roads, everything. There was nothing there in that level that were called manufacturing units and things like that. This
right.
was strictly getting it ready for D-Day. Subsequent to that, they ended up, after D-Day, they bombed a whole bunch of now into airplanes, airplane factories, production mm-hmm. of that type, because if you don't have fighters in the sky, you're going to be a lot better off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third was always there, was not just a manufacturing, but was oil.
Mm-hmm.
If they had no fuel, they weren't going to put airplanes in the sky. So that's how that happened, the three segments entirely mm-hmm. that way. And I was involved in all of them.
Wow.
I was, no, change it back, D-Day was after, before
mm-hmm, yeah,
me.
Mm-hmm.
But the others, and then, of course, this here, I'll get to that, or whatever, mm-hmm. this here, I'll get to that later.
Mm-hmm.
But that was as a result of the Battle of the Bulge, among other things. Mm-hmm. So, no, it was different.
Mm.
I have a different feeling now. There's we didn't care. Now every now and then I'll see the History Channel or see the Military Channel, and I see all the people in Germany. It's pitiful mm-hmm. that it ever happened that way. Could be you, could be he, whatever. Mm-hmm. Not really a fault of yours, and I can have sentiment for that, very much so, but not when we were playing the game.
Okay, so that's now, you're May 45, and you've just been promoted to captain. It's also VE Day, the 7th of May. Do you remember that?
I was on board a ship.
You were already...
Wait a minute. VE Day was what, the 8th?
7th? I think it was May 8th.
I was 1 mile, 1 day out of Boston coming back.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So you were already heading home.
Well, I should tell you that, too.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I finished my tour of 35 missions on April 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I was grounded, went on leave, spent some time, because they were shipping mm-hmm. me back to the U.S.
Right.
And that part of the story goes something like this, is we ended up getting on board in Southampton on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm walking down the ramp to enter the vessel, somebody yelled out, "Captain," and they're calling me. And I said, "Okay, yes, sir, what?" He says, "You're in charge of this ship going back to the United States."
You said, are?
Yeah, well, I was just told, I am. So that's how I got assigned to come back from Southampton, England, to Boston. I said, I have strange things. So anyway, I ended up being the commanding officer of 500 odd troops on the ship that was there. Don't even remember the name. It was a Liberty vessel.
Uh-huh.
And it worked out pretty good because Captain Bostrom, who was a P-51 pilot, he was one of the people coming back. I don't know, we struck up a conversation. And I said, "Well, why don't you share my stateroom? I got the best stateroom in the world. You can't have it any better than that." So anyway, I put him second in command. All we had to do is ride the vessel, but if something happened, which it didn't, everybody's had glad going home. So on May 8th, we ended up with a hurricane wind force operation out of Boston of 1945. Could move no further forward, and we had Boston on the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I was no longer in command. But that worked out very nice. Worked out very, very nice. Finished that up. Was given, sent home.
Mm-hmm.
Went through Taunton, I guess it was, or whatever. Right. And spent a few days home, 30 days to be exact.
Yeah.
And then I was back to Atlantic City. That's where I started. So went back to Atlantic City in June and ended up having an opportunity of what I wanted to do. And couldn't get out yet, mm-hmm. still military, so I signed up for the Air Transport Command, and that was for flying, and I was assigned to the base at Romulus, Michigan. And then from there I can go further, but if the combat area, I think we pretty near finished that, have we not?
We're getting there.
No, I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Anything more I need to tell you about flying over Europe or?
No, I think we're pretty well set on
all,
that.
It's all that you did that. You mm-hmm. did it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at it.
Okay, so you're in Romulus, Michigan. Where and when were you discharged?
Long time yet.
Oh, still a long time. Go ahead.
So I was sent to Romulus, Michigan. And at that point in time, my assignment was, with others,
mm-hmm.
to fly. They brought all the B-17s, mostly, and the B-24s back from Europe, brought them to Bradley Field, brought them to everywhere. Mm-hmm. Our job was to fly them to the scrap heap.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, a lot of these airplanes are not very good.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was in Romulus, Michigan from June until December.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew a lot of man hours flying aircraft that you'd be scared to get into, as well as everybody. Our instructions were, very simply, if you're going to take an aircraft, if you decide as first pilot it's not safe to fly, your instructions were to fix it just good enough to get it to the scrapyard.
And where is the scrapyard?
Kingman, Arizona. So that's, you just think about that. You're fixing something, you get it there just so you can throw it away.
So that's Kingman, a long Arizona, trash haul.
That was one of the rules. And again, the world is funny. And Romulus, fix it as good as you can. Put in only enough gas to get you there and save 15 or 20 minutes so that you're not mm-hmm. wasting gas. And sell it only to the person that's the signature is on your orders. Now, you could have stole them all.
Yeah.
I wish they did. They would be worth a lot. But anyway, no, you would land there on a Friday afternoon, nobody's there. Sign it. You could have gotten the airplane taken off, gone wherever you want. They'd never know because there were thousands of them out there in the fields. I have pictures of 1,800 and one in my office of 1,800 aircraft on the ground.
Wow.
Mostly B-17s. So anyway, that's what we did there.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I was asked to fly B-24s, which I did. On VJ days, I had a date with Miss Bomber Plant.
Miss Bomber Plant?
I like that. I got her name someplace.
Okay.
And so that's the career that went there.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, we did a lot of flying there, a lot of flying. They closed the base.
Mm-hmm.
So I was assigned to Memphis, the air base there, and doing more of the same, flying war worries.
Mm-hmm.
Now this was interesting because in Memphis, we got an assignment. Well, first of all, they had no quarters, so we had to live at the Hotel Peabody in mm-hmm. Memphis, a lovely hotel. That was tough duty, no question about it. But anyway, my assignment there was to take with B-24s, which is a four-engine Liberator and a Flying Fortress, to change the B-24s that were at Albrook Field in Panama and bring them brand new B-17s out of Morrison Field in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Morrison Field, Florida.
Yeah, uh-huh.
We're taking a new one down to Panama.
Right.
The B-17. We're bringing the B-24 back to take it to Kingman. Okay, they should have dropped them in the ocean. However, there's a, if you probably remember, I said something. If you go from Morrison Field, I don't know if you're familiar with what, that's in West Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 20 minutes to Havana and always get engine trouble, you got to land.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you got the message?
Yeah.
Had a nice visit, and then you go to Panama and change your airplanes, and coming back, gee, you got engine trouble in over Havana, you'd have to land again.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice trying. It took us quite a while to move a lot of airplanes. So anyway, that took care of Memphis. I did that, and still with the Air Transport Command. And then I guess we got that one closed down, so now they sent me to Long Beach. And I was with the Air Transport Command out there, but there was no quarters there, so we rented a house in Beverly Hills, and that wasn't bad mm-hmm. either. And spent the time there, and then one morning in June or something, I decided that enough was enough. So they gave me a choice of whether I wanted to continue with the military or go with the GI Bill and go to college and whatnot. So I retired from the military mm-hmm. in September of 1946. Except then I stayed with the reserves and the 131st Fighter Squadron in Westfield, Mass. Until 1951. So my career from the military is from 42 to 51.
Mm. All right, well, tell us what happened then, after you retired.
Well, strange things happen. Anyway, I don't want to say this. Oh, anyway, I retired, mm-hmm. went to work for a company by the name of, well, went to University of Mass first, then went to work for a company by the the Union Twist Drill Company, which made metal cutting tools for the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just 360,000 square foot building and whatnot, it's huge. And let's see, I guess 1951, 55, proceeded to raise a family,
mm-hmm.
play golf, do certain things, built a curling club in 1960, and worked for the company from, as I said, that point of time until 1983 or 84, 85, mm-hmm. when the company went out of business because of a labor problem.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was in top management or whatnot, I guess the situation sugars down to I ended up selling the company for Litton Industries,
mm-hmm.
and some nut by the name of Bill Purple bought it.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at him.
Okay.
Still own it, still go to work every day. So that's where I'm at.
Okay. And now, tell us about that lovely medal you're wearing upon your lapel.
Okay. Well, all right, I guess that finishes the career. I mean, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now, this particular medal
is
the Legion of Honor,
mm-hmm.
the highest medal that France puts out in their country. Several years ago,
mm-hmm.
just prior to, and it was 2012 to be exact,
mm-hmm.
I have a very good friend, his name is Don Casey. He's an attorney in Chicago, and we're still in communication. 379th Bomb Group,
mm-hmm.
he got blown out of the sky over in Europe, and he was a prisoner of war for 2 years, amongst other things,
mm-hmm.
and in conclusion type of thing, he said he had received one of these medals.
Yeah.
Someplace or other, Arlo Barsh, another fellow that's out in Arkansas now, received one. He's still alive. I talked to him last month. Same group. We're all very close because we went to reunions. I'll
mm-hmm.
come to that. So Don says he got this medal, and he says, Bill, he says, you qualify for that. And I said, what? And he says, I'm going to put your name in to the French consul here in Chicago and start the process because you and I know your career, we know each other and whatnot. He says, you are entitled to have this particular thing handled. So he did. So suddenly I got a flow of paper out of Chicago, out of New York, out of Washington, and out of Boston. And long story short, I filled out the necessary papers. And prior to last July, everything was still on the makings, and the Consul General in Boston, his buddy, or rather his superior, they were involved, and everything was okay. And July last year, I ended up getting a letter from the ambassador in Washington that said they had awarded me the Legion of Honor Medal from France, and that I should contact the Boston operation for presentation of the medal. And Timothy Deere, which I did do and whatnot, and, just, I said, so we got the medal. Well, Cindy, Chuck, and I, we decided we'd have some fun with it if we could. So knowing that I put the air show on at Orange, I said, wouldn't it be nice, because they award the medal, and by the way, they only put six of these out one year in the five states of the North, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. They don't have Connecticut. And they only gave five away last year. And they generally take and either have them at a dinner or mail them to her or whatnot. So our thought was, my personal thought was, wouldn't it be fun to have it awarded in front of a B-17? You know that. And so I contacted Timothy, and Timothy called me back shortly thereafter and said he talked with Fabian. And Fabian said whatever he did. Timothy called me back, says, well, the Consul General is very busy that week, but he will be there.
And Timothy is?
Who?
Timothy?
Timothy is the assistant for Fabian.
Okay.
And so that's where that came about. And so we put the things together with the necessary support people, and we had the medal awarded to us in Orange. Never knew. We put it together. Put them all on the plane. You were there then.
Oh,
were you
yes.
there when we took off?
I left just before you took
off. Yeah, well, I put them all on the plane. We all flew to Worcester, you know.
Yeah.
So that's where that particular thing happened, and I'm very proud of that. Because it handles that situation a different way. And again, I'm still here.
Okay. Well, Bill, first of all, let's get back to a little more general information. Did you join any veterans organizations aside from the reserves? Like VFW, Legion?
I belong to the American Legion, the VFW. I got our bomb group association and several other paralyzed people, and I do support the military.
Okay. And how important was it for you to serve in the military?
I'll make the statement that I make all the time. If you didn't get hurt bad, I think it was the greatest thing in the world anybody could ever live through, personally. Not counting the sadness of everything that happened. I think it made me, what would have been, how do I know, back in 1942 or 3. But I had the opportunity. I had the opportunity to go everywhere. That hat's been all over the world. Me under it. You know, it's that type of thing. I tell you, did I tell you I lost a hat?
You didn't.
You want to hear that?
Go right ahead.
That is 70 years old. That is the hat that they presented, or somebody, I got it, the day I was commissioned a second lieutenant. It has been with me many, many places. Well, 2012, we had the air show in Orange. We also had it in 2013, so I'm not, that's the year before what we just went through with this.
Yeah.
And I had gone through what our program was, went home that night, someplace, ended up going the next morning back to the airport and looked for my hat and I couldn't find it.
Oh no.
Where did it go? Where did it go? So, whatever, we looked all over. I know my son took and drove me that night, so we checked his car, we checked the road to his house, we checked my house, we checked everywhere. No hat.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess we put an ad in the paper. Hat lost. My pretty hat. And, but something else clicked in my mind, so I, during that morning, unknown in memory at that point, I had gone to Petersham to visit the grave of Mrs. Purple. And when I took the flowers out to put it at her gravesite, I put the hat on top of the car.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, okay. So, anyway, never gave it a thought, did what I was doing. That's when, from there, I drove to Orange, you see.
Uh-huh.
So, end the subject anyway, the hat's lost. So, I contacted, we all checked everything, couldn't find the hat, but we all looked for it. And then on Saturday, I called four neighbors by the cemetery and I inquired, and nobody found anything or whatnot. So, we said, all right. And then on Monday, on a follow-up, I live about 5 miles from the cemetery. Monday on a follow-up, I called up Poland and the girl answered there and I said, you know, I need to talk to your boss. And she was said he wasn't there. And I said, I'm looking for a hat. He says, well, Paul said, not Paul, but whatever his name was. He says, he's got a military hat sitting in a chair out with the horse barn. I said, what? Let's say that 5 miles doesn't take long to get there. I get over there, I come around the corner, and there's my little hat.
Oh.
What happened is when I drove off the cemetery, it just flew off and he had picked it up in the road.
Mm.
So, there you are.
Oh, wow. So, before we wrap up this interview, there's one little pertinent question. How did you get the nickname Bill?
That's easy. They nicknamed me Bill after my father.
Aha.
His name was Vincent.
Okay.
That's it.
That's it. Anything else before we wrap things up?
Oh, I could tell you millions. I'll tell you one final story.
Go right ahead.
You got time?
Yep.
Okay. If you flew a mission, chances are you might fly tomorrow, you might not fly the next day or the next day. On the other hand, one person, and I have that on my office desk right now, they had an airplane in our group that was called, I'm going to tell you two stories. They have an airplane that was called Calamity Jane. And Calamity Jane was flown by a fellow by the name of Plum.
Mm-hmm.
He flew, and why I'm asking is David Bramhall, I told you the gentleman that we did the thing with, he came to my office yesterday or the day before. He had his nice leather jacket on. He put a triangle K on it. He's smart. He was in the Navy. But anyway, he puts a triangle K on, and he's got the big name on the back, Calamity Jane. So I said, I got, that's the name I know, because it was in our group, ultimately. And I checked it out, and long story short, I'll mail that to him tomorrow. The fellow was in Europe in I-bomb group in 1943 early.
Mm-hmm.
He flew 18 missions. However, the 18th mission, they got blown out of the sky and that was the end of it.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And he doesn't know that. So that's on Calamity Jane. But when you didn't have missions, engines had to be replaced on the aircraft, tuned up, and then you would take and slow time them, which means fly them slow in the sky for 4 hours to break them in so that when you come back on the ground, they tighten up any malfunctions so that the aircraft can go to combat. You got that, right?
Right, uh-huh.
So my co-pilot, McKinnon and I and one other, only takes pilot and co-pilot and the engineer. We were airborne, and we were flying at about 8,000 feet someplace over there in England, and just burning up time doing our chore because there wasn't nothing else to do. And suddenly looked over, way over on the left, and there's a twin-engine airplane. But no, it's not an enemy, so we eased over and got very close to it. It was a British airplane.
Yeah.
And I looked over there, and I said, oh, So I tried to call him on the radio, but we weren't on the same frequency of the band. So eventually I was able to, my co-pilot's here, and the co-pilot over there who I'm talking to, I wanted to talk to her. I took and we finally come up with frequency 250 or something, made the connection with the co-pilot there and the co-pilot me, or rather me, right?
Right.
And I started talking. She had the most beautiful red hair. And I made a date with her right then and there.
Oh!
And we met several times.
Uh-huh.
So think about that. What's the odds of that? That's a pride story, you know.
Wow.
I have her name, too, and whatnot. We made the arrangements by radio that she would take and land at their base, take a train to what was common to both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out several times. But you can't do better than that.
No, no, sirree, Bob.
You can't do better.
Oh, Vincent, Bill Purple, thank you so much for taking part in the Natick Veterans Oral History
Project. Well, it was
a
pleasure.
It was for me, too.
Okay.